showed me what love is. Woman, you know, don't you know that's true? Good morning, good morning. You are on Higher Ground. I love Stevie Wonder, Higher Ground live at the Oz. This is yours truly, Sister Carol, in studio this morning. Brother A-Dub is here, just out of the studio for a second, but he'll be back. And I'll do all the preliminary before he joins me. And I want you to know the views and opinions here expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. These are the views and opinions of Sister Carol and Brother A-Dub. And I also want you to know that WEFT is conducting a survey, so we'll repeat this a couple of times. WEFT is conducting a survey of our listeners, and we want you to go to the homepage at weft.org and click on the link that takes you about a 2-minute survey. We appreciate your feedback. It helps us improve the station. So go to weft.org and complete this short 2-minute survey and help give feedback about your listening experience with WEFT. And we're going to have a great show this morning. I am here and available for you, just so that you know. You can call the station here at 217-359-5483. You can fly live, and I will answer any questions that you have about any subject, state or non-state. We are very happy to do that, but we want to do our own tribute to the late, great Muhammad Ali. And so for those who may not know, Brother Aaron and I had the pleasure of seeing Brother Muhammad Ali in a mosque in Chicago on April 14th, 2002. And it was 2 weeks before he and I got married. And so that was a great privilege for us to be able to see him in person and just be in a space and witness his energy. I've had an opportunity to meet his second wife. And so this is just a real privilege for us to do our dedication to the late, great Muhammad Ali. And we will certainly take your calls about your experience. A lot of people, I've watched Brother Adub say that even though they didn't know him, and we didn't know him, so to speak, right? We only got a chance to see him. They didn't know him, but they still felt connected to him. And of course, the world is mourning his passing. But for us, it is certainly more of a celebration of his life. And his life was so magnificent that we can celebrate his life for a lifetime. And so this morning, we'll share a little bit of our love of Muhammad Ali with you. And we'll talk about a few other things. Brother Adub, go ahead and greet the audience this morning.
Good morning, WFT. This is Brother A-Dub, a.k.a. All right, so we're going to play this a little piece of Muhammad Ali, I Am the Greatest.
Oh, okay. Give me a second to find out where that is.
Just press play.
Oh, okay. You're so good with this.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, from Louisville, Kentucky, wearing black tie, Mr. Cassius Marcellus Clay. For his first reading, Mr. Clay will honor us with a recitation of his classic poem, I Am the Greatest.
I am the greatest. By Cassius Clay. This is the legend of Cassius Clay, the most beautiful fighter in the world today. He talks a great deal and brags indeed of a muscular punch that's incredibly speedy. The fistic world was dull and weary. With a champ like Liston, things had to be dreary. Then someone with color, someone with dash, brought fight fans a-running with cash. This brash young boxer is something to see, and the heavyweight championship is his destiny. This kid fights great. He's got speed and endurance. But if you sign to fight him, increase your insurance. This kid's got a left. This kid's got a right. If he hits you once, you're asleep for the night. And as you lie on the floor, while the ref counts 10, you pray that you won't have to fight me again. For I am the man this poem is about. The next champ of the world, there isn't a doubt. This I predict. And I know the score. I'll be champ of the world in 64. When I say three, they go into third. So don't bet against me. I'm a man of my word. If Casher says a cow can lay an egg, don't ask how. Grease that skillet. He is the greatest. Yes, I'm the man this poem is about. I'll be champ of the world. There isn't a doubt. Here I predict Mr. Liston's dismemberment. I'll hit him so hard, he'll wonder where October and November went. When I say two, there's never a third. Betting against me is completely absurd. When Casher says a mouse can outrun a horse, don't ask how. Put your money where your mouse is. I am the greatest.
All right, all right. Good morning, y'all. This is Brother A-Dub down here on your higher ground, 90.1 FM on your listening dial. And, of course, you were listening to an excerpt from a CD that was cut by then Cassius Clay, better known to the world as Muhammad Ali. And so we wanted to, as I've been watching a lot of the different things taking place, all of the coverage and stuff around the passing or transition of Muhammad Ali, we, you know, often when history is being written, it determines, well, the person who's writing it sort of determines how it will be written or how it may even be received by the world. And so what we have seen, for instance, I was watching the ESPN coverage yesterday morning, and I heard one of the sportscasters whose father used to cover the fights and have interactions with Muhammad Ali, some pretty personal interactions with him even. And I heard the sports writer and the announcer talk about Muhammad Ali in a sense that his words were that Muhammad Ali wasn't well versed in history, and he really wasn't always up on current events, but he was such a compassionate and kind man and full of humor and laughter. And you know, it just bothers me to no end that we would take a man of this stature and this courage, this level of courage and dignity and integrity and only offer the pieces like, you know, the humorous side of him, because that's the most comforting component for most people and the most non-threatening component. But to me, when you think about what's been taking place with this Bernie Sanders movement and all of the people all over the country who are excited about challenging the status quo now, when you think about the time when then Cassius Clay decided to change his name to Muhammad Ali, or was given the name Muhammad Ali by Elijah Muhammad of the Nation of Islam, you don't hear that conversation. You don't hear the position that he took. You don't hear the in-depth discussions and reasons why he decided that he and refused to be inducted into the army to go to war, where we have groups like the AWARE anti-war, anti-racism effort in town. You have people who have been fighting against what they consider to be unjust or unnecessary wars. You have a man of his magnitude and who influenced many of the decisions that you see taking place today. You have, he has so much more to him, his evolution as a man, even from the name changing to a boxer, to his accepting of the Orthodox Islam, his children, the wives. I mean, there's so much more to him as a man and what drove him as a man, that it is an insult to his life to only categorize him and characterize him as some sort of comedian. Right. And so while I wanted to play an excerpt or two of this particular CD when he was using his skill set as a comedian. There are also other YouTube clips and videos of him having very poignant and frank conversations around race. And I think those are as important as we deal with those issues. I mean, I've heard people call him a racist. You know, I mean, it's just a lot of different things that are taking place around the life of Muhammad Ali. And I thought that it was good. It would be good for us to open up the lines and have conversations, kick off our Saturday morning with a more more in-depth conversation about who the man is that many knew as Muhammad Ali, who changed his name back in the early 60s, I believe it was, to Muhammad Ali, and getting rid of what he called his slave name. So I'm just going to read a little bit of what we have here on the Wikipedia to wet everybody's whistle a little bit, and then we'll go from there. So Muhammad Ali, born Cassius Marcellus Clay Jr., January 17, 1942, and died June 3, 2016, was an American Olympic and professional boxer and activist. He is widely regarded as one of the most significant and celebrated sports figures of the 20th century. From early in his career, Ali was known as an inspiring, controversial, and polarizing figure both inside and outside the ring. And so this is one of the things that that really strikes me, is because controversial and polarizing. I guess during that time, I wasn't born in 1960. So, I mean, I didn't take my first breath of air out here until 1971. So I'm not sure exactly if he was a polarizing figure when he took a position that I'm not going to war, because ain't no Viet Congs over there ever called me nigga, is what he said. You know, and my problem is with white folks here who have been oppressing me and sicking dogs on me and beating my people and all that kind of different stuff. That's the position that he took. Am I wrong? You making faces and stuff.
I'm not making faces at all. It's considered polarizing when you try to hold the system and the people accountable. Then the people who write it says you're polarizing. That's the whole point.
And so, you know, that's interesting, because what we would, when you were stepped away for a minute, I was talking about, it's the people who write history,
yeah,
who write it from a particular perspective.
Sure.
And I was talking about the sports writer who said that Muhammad Ali was not aware of history and of current events. Yet you're talking about the man who took a position on the war based upon history and current
and
events.
And his awareness.
Right?
And his awareness.
You know, so, you know, you have to be very, you have to be aware. You have to know history as well in order to critique it, or to know when someone's whitewashing you, right? Okay, about the true aspects or true nature of this man's life. And just from a standpoint of media and writing your own history, I do want to announce that the WOE Project, Working on Excellence, is doing a march today over in Garden Hills. And these are some young people, young African-American, a guy and I think a young lady who pulled this together. I don't have all the details on the WOE Project itself, but I have talked to Teddy and the young lady who are pulling this together. And they're doing this march. They're starting over at 9:30 at the Unemployment Center on Mattis. They're gathering there, and the walk will begin. The march will begin at 10. And they're going to march around Garden Hills and that area over there to bring more awareness, or to show their opposition to the gun violence that's taking place there. And the project is called Working on Excellence, the WOE Project. So when I leave here, I'm going to go, of course, and join them and participate and give them our support and give the community our support. And I do think it sort of fits into what we're talking about here, because one of the things that Muhammad Ali, as much as he fought against racism, he also pushed for black excellence, right? So I Am the Greatest was also an attempt for him to show other young black people, or show the world that you can accomplish what you will. But in particular, he had a message to the black community. That's why it resonated with him to join the Nation of Islam and all those different things, and to to push in our community for us to clean ourselves up and to be the best that we possibly can and to do for ourselves. So I do believe that there's something that's important and connected to this whole WOW project and what these young people are trying to say about us taking the reins and taking a stance against the violence that's taking place in our communities. And I know that they need a broader analysis of the poverty and all the different circumstances that help create that. But I just wanted to announce, and I'll say it again before the radio show is up, the WOW Project doing a Stop the Violence or March Against Gun Violence in our community. 9 o'clock, 9:15 or so, they're gathering at the Unemployment Center in that parking lot on Mattis Avenue. And they're going to be marching down around Garden Hills, Hedge Road, and those areas where these sites of violence have taken place. There's been two or three deaths in Garden Hills. And so we want to get our support, put our support behind young people who are trying to make a difference in the community.
I wanted to just kind of read a little bit that I have on Muhammad Ali and how it struck me. But, you know, there have been a number of sports heroes in the 20th century who became bigger than life by both deed and fable. Babe Ruth, Joe Louis, Jesse Owens, and Joe DiMaggio. And there are many other, even recently, basketball icon Michael Jordan have transcended the business world. But no athlete weighed so heavily on the public's consciousness as Muhammad Ali. He was a three-time heavyweight champion who first captured the imagination by successfully predicting the round he would dispose his rival in. So that's what he was known for. Ali never fit the stereotype role we had shaped for the king of boxing, like Lewis did. If the heavyweight champion's ideal was, like Joe Lewis, carry a big punch in the ring, but walk softly outside the ropes, Ali turned that model upside down. Using the title as his bully pulpit, he forced people to choose sides, lecturing the world on Vietnam, racism, sexism, and the emerging third world nations. By refusing induction into the service during the Vietnam War on religious grounds, he was viewed as a traitor or a martyr. But the politicians stole his heavyweight crown without due process and exiled him from the ring for 3 years. He told everyone who questioned his transformation to the Muslim faith, quote, "I don't have to be who you want me to be." And seldom did he adhere to the consensus of opinion, nor did he match the conventional mode of past heavyweight champions who relied mainly on power instead of using his remarkable speed of hand and foot to whoop such giants as Sonny Liston and Joe Frazier. And late in his career, guile and inventiveness to upset the seemingly invincible George Foreman. Where he once divided America with his social and religious beliefs, Ali, his body now ravaged with Parkinson's disease, and we just lost him in the last decade. He was still a symbol of peace and hope, carrying the torch for all of America. And I think that that's why so many people respect him today. Now, of course, yesterday, right? That's why they considered him polarizing, because he identified with the suffering of the black masses. And at that time, the masses of people around the world, as he began to travel, he one of his interviews, he talked about seeing the condition of people all over the world, poor people, third world countries that were being not only exploited, but the Vietnam War became a real part of his platform to oppose the war. And so here we are today on the cusp of his homegoing service yesterday, really having to examine the real Muhammad Ali. Now, of course, the mainstream media loves to give you the, you know, the funny, jolly joke telling. And that's a part of him, right? That's who he is. But what was he talking about? And what was the social implications of what he talked about? That's the important part of Muhammad Ali to me.
You know, and I love the entire man, right? You know what I mean? Because he had some great some great lines. If somebody dream about whooping me, they better wake up and apologize, right?
Yeah,
I mean, he was, and even in his wittiness in his quick-witted responses and stuff, there was depth to what he was saying.
Yes.
Right? You know, so I wanted to share a little piece here. It says, Cassius Clay was born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky, and began training as a boxer when he was 12. So just stop for a minute. We've been discussing preparation, training. Are you prepared for the job at hand? Right? Now, I don't. Whether it's football and a bunch of head collisions or boxing and a bunch of punches to the head, I don't encourage my son or any other young people to go out and choose this as a career path. I just don't, right? I think it's, I believe that if Muhammad Ali was going to get Parkinson's disease, I believe it was certainly sped up tremendously by all the punches that he took to the head, especially later on in his career when he slowed down, and the Joe Frazier's, George Foreman's, and, you know, Kenny Norton and Larry Holmes, these people who he took a lot of punches from later on in his career. But he started training at 12. Somebody stole his bike and he was upset about it and he wanted to do something about it, right? You know, and he felt like he needed to learn how to defend himself. And so he went to the gym at 12 years old to learn how to box. And at 18, he won the light heavyweight gold medal in the 1960 Summer Olympics in Rome. So again, the message underneath it all is go train, prepare mm-hmm. yourself to maximize your skill and talent. Of course, his foot speed, his hand speed, all of those things, his ability to get into his opponent's head were all things that helped him in his career. But it was also the training that made a difference. And he converted to Islam shortly after that. At 22, he won the WBC and the WBA heavyweight championship from Sonny Liston. Clay then changed his legal name from Cassius Clay, which he called his slave name, to Muhammad Ali, and gave a message of racial pride for African-Americans and resistance to white domination during the 1960 civil rights movement. So now, when you talk about his the heavyweight title gives you a platform. First of all, right, that Sonny Liston was, you know, was known as a mafia guy and an on the take. And a lot of people think he threw the fight against Muhammad Ali anyway, especially the second fight. And but then to take that platform now and use it and say, listen, I'm going to rid myself of my slave name. And I want you to refer to me as Muhammad Ali. That's my new name. That was a whole process. The media, his opponents, even black folks, even black fighters that he fought, refused to call him Muhammad Ali. Mm-hmm. And there was a infamous scene where one of the fighters, he kept hitting him in the middle of the ring and say, what's my name? And would keep hitting him. And even that went on further into the annals of time where, you know, people would use that in their songs and all that type of stuff. What's my name? And, you know. So he had an impact even on the hip hop community.
Yeah.
Right. You know, so, but he was challenging this status quo, as you said. First of all, I'm going to use this bully pulpit as a heavyweight champion. I'm going to change my name and, from Cassius Clay, which I consider a slave name, to Muhammad Ali. So now you have a conversion to Islam and then to take the position against the war. You have, you're not talking about somebody who's just going along to get along. He was stripped of his heavyweight title in the prime of his career to take a principal position against the war. Right. And I mean, that's just so connected to today, you know, that, you know, we've been talking about this, that to speak truth, how do you make history relevant till today? Right. And the life of this man, taking the history and the historical stances that he took to challenge the status quo. I do not have to live inside the box that you put me in, whether it's this ring, right? Your religion, the way you've named me, any of those different things. I do not have to live in that box, and you're not going to make me. And I'm going to stand here and still continue to do what I love to do.
I think they actually, during the Vietnam piece, he was already boxing, right?
Yeah.
They reclassified to draft him because of, you know, different decisions by the government to draft the number one boxer in the country into the war at the time. He was reclassified to be drafted. So that was part of that was also part of the swirling thing around. And I think Muhammad Ali did an interview about that saying, and you mean to tell me that I'm traveling, I'm the number one boxer in the world, and you draft me during my boxing career? And so that was part of his, that was part of his platform when he took the anti-war position. He knew that there was an intentional draft.
So, and along the lines of what you're sharing, take your time, take a drink there. In 1966, 2 years after winning the heavyweight title, Ali further antagonized the white establishment in the U.S. by refusing to be conscripted into the U.S. military, citing his religious beliefs and opposition to American involvement in the Vietnam War. He was eventually arrested, found guilty of draft evasion charges, and stripped of his boxing titles. He successfully appealed in the U.S. Supreme Court, which overturned his conviction in 1971. 5 years later, almost 5 years later. By that time, he had not fought for nearly 4 years, losing a period of peak performance as an athlete. Ali's actions as a conscientious objector to the war made him an icon for the larger counterculture generation.
I think that's the part, and he's quoted. He says, I think you got one on that CD that you have over there. It says, the power structure seems to want to starve me out. I mean, the punishment, 5 years in jail, $10,000 fine ain't enough. They want to stop me from working, not only in this country, but out of it. And so he was willing to sacrifice everything for the anti-war position he took. And people began to really pay attention to, well, not began, but they were already paying attention to him, but really listen to, at that time, the number of not only big icons like himself and actors who were anti-war at that time. And I think he added to a chorus that was ultimately going to lead to, of course, the demonstrations and protests that took place around the Vietnam War era. But he was a, I would not say complicated man, but he was pretty clear. I think he was a clear speaker and direct speaker, which is something that I appreciated about him. He believed in his convictions and he stood on it. And everything, every interview that you can see of Muhammad Ali, I hope people are going back and saying, you know, who was this man and what did he stand for? You know, don't listen to the, you know, media's rendition of, you know, reducing him to a jovial character. I remember, you know, nowadays, you know, everybody loves Malcolm X, but did nobody love Malcolm X when he was talking about
loves Malcolm X.
Well, but, you know, he's a more mainstream acceptable icon than he was when he was alive preaching.
Yeah.
So in that regard, you know, you take your figures after they were gone, they didn't all love Dr. King, but nowadays everybody seemed to love Dr. King.
Everybody marched with him.
He's an acceptable, everybody marched with Dr. King, right?
He was born in 1989 and marched with King, huh?
So, I mean, when you start looking at Muhammad Ali's life, you really want to look at the actual life of the man, not the image of the man that the media decides to create for you.
And I do think that when you start talking about create, I always talk about the context in which in the time frame in which people lived, what was going on around them in their environment to sort of shape the way they thought about things. Right. So as Muhammad Ali said, that when his bike was stolen and he wanted to whoop the guy that stole his bike, he had to go learn how to do that. Right. So the context was created for him to even pursue boxing by a violation that occurred. Somebody stole his bike, right? You're talking about a poor young man with three or four other brothers and sisters living in a two or three bedroom house, right?
Two bedroom.
Right? And he's saying, this bike meant something to me and you took it from me, right? There's context. And so when you talk about who he evolved into, why he took the positions against the Vietnam War, why he referred to Cassius Clay as a slave name, you can't have the conversation about those things without talking about the context. So what was America? What did America look like and feel like for a young African-American man in 1955? Right. You know, 1960. He was born in 42. Right. So what is life like for a 12-year-old in 1954? Right.
Right.
And what is it like for him at 18 in 1960? Right. And for him to the courage for him to take such a position like that, to say, I'm going to be a conscientious objector. And I'm going to give up, I mean, millions of dollars at a time. Like right now, $1 million doesn't seem like a whole bunch of money to some people, right?
But it's a lot to me.
It's still a lot to me. But I'm just saying, then to think about the prime of his career, to walk away from huge ticket sales, huge. You see Floyd Mayweather or somebody like that making $100 million. Right. Just on ticket sales and all that kind of different stuff. So his opportunity as a heavyweight champion back then, when everybody wanted to see Muhammad Ali either win or lose, he gave that up, and he knew he was going to be stripped of the title. He knew that there was going to be all these other negative consequences as far as his career and his ability to fight. And he still stood strong on it. And as you said, they were trying to starve him out, hoping that he would cave in and say, well, you know, I'll give up.
Right? Sounds kind of familiar to me. Right. We'll come back to that, you know, on the starve out people.
Yeah, exactly. So I just think that underneath it all, you have to talk about the context of the situation, not just the decision that was made, because there's usually an environment and there's some things going on in the mind or in the life of the individual to precipitate or to help them as a catalyst for them to make a particular decision. Right. And so when I think about that, I think about what was going on in that time frame.
I wanted to see the piece, I Am the Greatest. I think people can still order the CD. It's called I Am the Greatest, under Cassius Clay. And there was a piece on here that we used to listen to, certainly when, it's called The Knockout. At some point, Aaron played The Knockout for us.
What number is it?
Actually, it's number 8. It's called Round 8, The Knockout.
So stay tuned. Let's play The Knockout, and we'll come right back.
People ask me who will be the next heavyweight champion after me. And I tell them, I intend to hold the championship for 8 years. Then I'm going to give it to my younger brother, Rudolph, like the Kennedys do in Washington. When I retire, I will become an even bigger businessman than I am now. I'm already a big businessman, but I'm going to be the AT&T of the fistic world. I have a unique product. I sell good boxing, a beautiful body, culture, and the world's most perfect face. I'm so beautiful, the girls think I'm Chubby Champion. I am the greatest. I'm too much. When I retire from the ring, I'm going into business by making boxers out of other handsome, talented, cultured young men. If a kid can box, and if he can write poetry, and if he's anywhere near as pretty as me, I'll sign him to a contract. I will have a stable of fighters, a coast-to-coast chain of Cassius Clays. The flyweight Cassius Clay will weigh 112 pounds, and he will write short little poems. The heavyweight Cassius Clay will write long elegies. They all will predict things. They will predict that I will be the first man elected to the Hall of Fame while I'm still alive. And they won't have to put up a statue of me, because I will appear at the Hall of Fame in person, live from New York, in living color. Yes, I will revolutionize the boxing world. And then I will revolutionize the literary world. First, I will get rid of the beatnik poets. And I will make the world safe for cleanliness. We don't need beatniks. Their poems don't rhyme. Their clothes don't match. And they can't fight a lick. I saw some of those beatniks doing my poetry reading in Greenwich Village. One beatnik had bare feet, dirty fingernails, and a long beard. You know, if that beatnik had put on shoes, gotten a manicure, and a shave, she'd been beautiful. And she had the nerve to challenge me to a poetry duel. I predicted that I would beat that beatnik with one quick poem to the brain, and I did. I said, "Little Miss Beatnik, go sit on your seatnik." Now, I beat her with that short little old poem, and I can write even shorter poems. While I'm talking to you, I'm writing the greatest short poem of all time. This poem tells how I feel to be as great as I am. This is it. The greatest short poem of all time. Me, wee!
So one of the things that we have the the beauty of having when you have an alternative radio program like WEFT, you have the ability to rewrite the story and rewrite the narrative and to write it from the perspective, from your perspective. Right. So that's what we're doing down here. Sister Carol, Brother A-Dub live on WEFT 90.1 FM on your listening dial. You can also call a friend or a loved one and say, listen, go to weft.org and click on Higher Ground, listen live, and they can join the conversation. And you can give us a call down here, 217-359-5483 or 217-359-6545. 217-359-5483 or 217-359-6545. I would really love to hear from individuals who were alive during the era of Muhammad Ali, when he was especially in his prime and when he was taking some of the positions that he was taking, and to help us who were not there or who were not old enough to understand even the climate and what was taking place. I'd love for one of you to give us a call down here this morning and talk a little bit about what the stances that Ali, that the Muhammad Ali took, and how it impacted the community, the world, from your perspective as someone who was maybe alive and well and conscious of what was taking place and what his decisions meant to the black community and to the world at large. So give us a call down here, 217-359-5483 or 217-359-6545. One of the our underwriters is Kevin Elliott Counseling. Elliott Counseling Group has 35 counselors providing mental health services for individuals, families, couples, children, and groups. Evening and weekend appointments are often available immediately. Virtually all insurance, including state employee insurance, is accepted. There's also a self-pay sliding scale. You can contact Kevin Elliott or his staff at ElliottCounselingGroup.com. That's E-L-L-I-O-T-T, CounselingGroup.com. Or you can reach them at 217-398-9066. Again, that number is 217-398-9066 to reach Kevin Elliott Counseling.
Interestingly, there's a little poem that was written. It was a song they used to sing during the Vietnam War protests, and the chorus went like, "Uptight, that's right, I ain't gonna go, hell no." And then it says, "I ain't gonna go to Vietnam to kill my brother for the man. Ain't gonna go to Vietnam. I gotta work here in Harlem, Watts, and Birmingham. Ain't gonna go to Vietnam. The Viet Cong is like I am." And so they used to sing this song during the protests. And of course, since that war, we've had any number of wars that, whether you agree or disagree, we've always been engaged in some other war somewhere else, which is, of course, costing the lives of our soldiers here from America. And that's a big piece of our conversation because of his anti-war positions that he took. That certainly has relevance today. And the quote that he gave in 1967, spring of 1967, he says, "No, I'm not going 10,000 miles to help murder, kill, and burn other people to simply help continue the domination of white slave masters over dark people of the world. This is the day and age when such evil injustice must come to an end." And he said that in the spring of 1967. Because, of course, at that time and at this time, we're still fighting wars based on not necessarily the national protection of America, but the national interests of America, which is a totally different thing.
Or of a select few
of a select
in
few,
America. Right?
The 1% at the top, which is what all of the recent protests have been about, the 99% protests and all these other protests that have taken place since that time, really illustrate why people have to become more conscious about what they're doing. But he was an athlete during a period of time where, of course, they didn't want athletes to take a position on anything. They don't want athletes to take a position on anything today.
That's right.
And it's an important thing to lift up about Muhammad Ali, and hopefully his life as he transcends will impact athletes today to make them take a stance on the most pressing issues that are affecting the community and the country today. And
Muhammad Ali was a part of that group of Jim Brown, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was once known as Lew Alcindor, who also changed his name to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Jim Brown, Bill Russell. And there was a slew of black athletes who took very strong stances on making sure that they would use that platform as being the NBA champion or the NFL top star or the heavyweight champion of the world to raise the issues that were affecting the black community and poor people in particular, but poor people at large, but black people in particular. And they took very strong stances. Jim Brown is still known for taking those stances and working in the community. And it's interesting to watch the narratives be told, because others might say, well, during that time, you also had Jackie Robinson, who didn't take those types of public stances for the most part. But one of the things that we have learned as we've gone through history and looked at, we're not going to play this game of pitting African-American icons and leaders against one another, right? Mm-hmm. Because the objective was the same, was to bring some sort of justice and equality, economic opportunities, or just freedom to be yourself to the black man and woman in North America, period, right? Whether it was Muhammad Ali or Malcolm X or Dr. Martin Luther King, whoever it was, people were still catching the same hell. Jackie Robinson caught the same hell that Muhammad Ali did, right? Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's just important for us to think about not only the context, but also, is there progress? You know, so what has happened? What did Muhammad Ali do? And what his stances, how did it help progress the condition of black folks in America and of humanity, right? You know, so there's a lot to be said about, in my opinion, about, like you said, the wars and the position that he took on the Vietnam War. But I also think there's a lot to be said about when you look at his core principles and the things that he believed in that all young people should strive to achieve, right? You know, he was a good human being, right? You know, he wasn't a pacifist, right? You know what I mean? He didn't believe in just letting people walk all over you, right? But he didn't come forward with the intention to do harm unnecessarily, right? To people who didn't mean any harm to him. But, anyway, I thought it was important to sort of point out that there are lots of athletes even today. I know Cleveland got smashed last night. They lost again. But I have a tremendous amount of respect for LeBron James. Right. You're talking about athletes who have a stage now to take a different position. LeBron talks a lot about, you know, not allowing the number of championships he wins or loses to determine whether or not to be the his sole goal in life. He said, look, I came from Akron, Ohio, the inner city of Ohio with a single mother. I'm not supposed to be here. Right. And so I'm trying to be a beacon of light to a whole bunch of other young people. And so I'm trying to make good decisions. You don't read about me in the newspapers being in for domestic violence, getting caught with drugs and stuff like that. The conversations for me around my basketball status or whatever, how many championships I won. But that's not going to be how you define me. Right. You know what I mean? And so The Miami Heat do not take a position in hoodies about Trayvon Martin without LeBron James. Okay, so I'm saying that there's some other athletes, and we're asking these other folks who are in these high profile positions to take some strong positions on how things are what's developing in the country.
I debate whether them putting a hoodie on has any real raises to the level of the sacrifice of a Muhammad Ali.
I agree with that.
No way. But I'd like to just share something I learned about Dr. King Muhammad Ali. On August 23rd, 1966, Ali became engaged in what some consider the greatest fight of his life when he applied with the Selective Service for conscientious objection status on religious ground as a member of as a minister with the Nation of Islam, which began years of court battles leading all the way up to the Supreme Court, which in 1971, the court overturned his draft conviction. But then on April 4th, 1967, some 8 months after Ali filed for an objector status, Atlanta's renowned leader, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., made his famous anti-Vietnam speech at Riverside Church in New York City, entitled Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence. Mm-hmm. King had also been empowered by Muhammad Ali to then break his silence about his opposition to the war. Like Ali, he was criticized by the press and other black leaders. I remember being stunned by the press and others after King made his speech against the war and then becoming the internationalist, as they are quoted to say. So it was interesting that Muhammad Ali took this stance, and then there's a picture of Muhammad Ali and Dr. King with reporters in Louisville, and they're questioning Dr. King and Muhammad Ali about their criticism of the war. But when Dr. King came out against the war in Vietnam in 67, he was criticized by mainstream press and his own advisors, who told him not to focus on, quote, foreign policy. Every advisor on King's staff, except Reverend James Bevel, who encouraged him to come out against the Vietnam War, others advised him not to. But Dr. King forged ahead and to justify his new stand, said publicly, quote, like Muhammad Ali puts it, we are all black and brown and poor victims of the same system of oppression, end quote. And that's the quote from Dr. King. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting, just people, his political consciousness is more relevant today. And we need actually to study his political consciousness and share that with the children so that they can understand why chasing the dollar cannot be your number one objective.
That's right.
Right? Because the rich will always try to starve you out.
Or they will buy you.
They will either buy you or starve you. But they will do one or the other, right?
They will attempt to do one or the other.
Or they'll attempt, if you allow them to.
That's right.
To buy you out or to starve you out, right? To make you say that the things that you have are more important than
the values and the principles that you
live by. That's right, than the values and principles that you should live by and that you should stand on. And you know, we know, we, meaning you and I personally know, how important it is for us to not get so wrapped up into the things. Because the same person who made those things available for you will attempt to take them away from you. And then you become either the victim of a sellout or you'll stand up for what you know is right. Mm-hmm. And I encourage people to stand up for what they know is right.
You know, there was a scene in one of the films that Muhammad Ali actually played himself in the film, where one of the promoters before the, I think it was the Floyd Patterson fight, one of the other heavyweight champions before Ali, who was a Christian and was very opposed to Muhammad Ali's faith, right? And so they decided to get in a fight, and the promoter told Ali that he would lose the fight. They would not have the fight if he was to continue inviting Malcolm X to mm-hmm. and having a Muslim women or whoever it was around him or preparing food and all that kind of different stuff. If any of that stuff continued to take place, that the fight would be called off. And Muhammad Ali said, well, look, you know, I understand the business aspect of this. If you want me to wait till after the fight to announce my change or whatever, you know, fine, mm-hmm. I'll do something like that. But if you think that I'm going to give up what I believe in to satisfy these other folks who don't care nothing about me, mm-hmm. I'm not willing to do that. And so if the fight is off, then the fight is off and I'm out of here. And he left, right? Because what he was establishing, like just like you said, in a capitalist society in particular, where big bank thinks he can always take little bank.
Yep.
Or, you know, those who like a Ronner or any of these other billionaire folks, they think they can just buy you yeah. or starve you out.
Starve you out.
Right. You know, yeah. that you don't have the dignity or the integrity to say that I'm not, you know, succumbing to your wishes just mm-hmm. because you have more money.
Right.
Right. That there's something else that drives my existence beyond what drives yours. Right. Mm-hmm. Money is not my God. That's basically right. is what Ali was saying to him. And I believe that, again, the relevance of what we saw with and the tail end now of even this, the Bernie Sanders campaign, what invigorated so many young people, what invigorated you and I, and what made us want to take the positions that we have taken politically is because we believe that we know that these changes are necessary. And if you allow big banks, these super PACs and Wall Street and all these other folks to buy you, right, then you'll never get the changes that you're looking for, because no. every time you give in, they say, okay, our price just wasn't high enough. We'll just give a higher price to them. Or we'll buy somebody else. We'll bring somebody else in that's to right. replace them.
Yeah.
And as a union man, that's exactly what we see starting to take place in the state of Illinois, with Ronner wanting to break the unions and say, well, you know, we got other people who will come in and work for less. Right. And but they win in that regard, because that gives those billionaires, those 1% folks who have so much money and so many resources. They don't care. You're just numbers at that particular point. You're not even human anymore at that point. You are just a number, and they replace this number with that number, and they just keep on moving.
I think it's interesting because Dr. King and Muhammad Ali both shared a real quest for social justice. And at some point, the FBI was, you know, they followed Dr. King and Muhammad Ali around, and they recorded them secretly during the COINTELPRO. What do you call that? Illegal wiretapping episodes of the FBI. And Dr. King and Muhammad Ali both shared a bond in their commitment against the war and for social justice. It wasn't a popular bond, and it deserves to be remembered. So I'm going to read this little piece for you. It says, as the 1960s propelled forward, both men were part of a common black freedom struggle that was blurring the lines between nationalism versus integrationism, taking not only the legal barriers of integration set forth by Jim Crow, but the intractable racism of the North. We know of their friendship only because of those invaluable stenographers at the FBI. Here is one FBI wiretap summary with Dr. Martin Luther King, in which Muhammad Ali is referred to derisively as C for Cassius Clay. It's, quote, MLK spoke to C. They exchanged greetings. C invited MLK to be his guest at the next championship fight. MLK said he would like to attend. C said he is keeping up with MLK, and MLK is his brother, and he is with him 100%, but can't take any chances, and that MLK should take care of himself and should watch out, quote, watch out for them whites. Interestingly, we know of these wiretaps only because of the March 8, 1971 break-in of activists into the FBI office. They chose March 8th because it was the night of the first Frazier Ali fight, and they knew the guards would be distracted with the rest of the country. So Ali and Dr. King saw their connection become unbreakable in 1967 when King made the courageous decision, against the wishes of his advisors, to take a stand against President Johnson's escalation of the war in Vietnam. By this time, Ali had already become the most visible draft resister in the country, standing strong despite the stripping of his heavyweight title and threat of 5 years in Leavenworth. So he has such a impressive resume, right? To take on the most powerful country on the planet and win. Ultimately, he did win the overturning of his conviction, and his removal from boxing was reinstated. And he went on, as you know, to box after that. But his life and his legacy is what young people and even older people really need to know. Instead of calling him the divisive one, the story really should be told that he stood up against racism and injustice that was being perpetrated, not against just him, but against the entire world and his community. And I remember the interview he did. He said, they said, "Hey, Muhammad, why are you taking these positions? You seem like you're doing well." He said, "You know, I may be doing well personally. I'm doing well. But as long as my people are not doing well, then I'm not well." And he tied his love for the condition of Black people to his own success. And he didn't say, "Oh, I'm just going to be successful and I'm going to leave the rest of these people. Y'all get yours where you can, you know, get in where you fit in." Like some people do, the capitalists do today, tell you the story that you should do well, right? You should make a lot of money. And, you know, those folks, they'll have to do their own. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. If you don't do that, you must not be smart. So this whole thing that the rich try to do is to make you think that they're rich by their own doing. And if you look deeper into it, you may find that they're rich by the exploitation of others. And so you got to be careful about how you describe a person's condition. And I think Muhammad understood that.
Mm-hmm. I was just kind of taking a look at one of the clips from one of my favorite movies, When We Were Kings.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing. And it showed a level of consciousness. The When We Were Kings video talks about the fight leading up to the Rumble in the Jungle, which was the fight with George Foreman in Zaire. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that was even controversial at that time because of the leader of Zaire was not someone who, if I'm recollecting correctly, was a friend of America. Right. But Don King and the promoters, they had James Brown and all these top folks in the music industry and the boxing industry to set the fight in Zaire. And remember, they had the Thrill in Manila and things like that. Right. So watching this clip, I mean, when I watched Muhammad Ali, even when he went to the motherland, when he was back on the continent, you had two brothers that were fighting. But the people, even against the odds, were all behind Ali. The children were running with him in the morning, and just the whole country was wrapped around his finger, basically, because they understood that he understood the plight of the people.
Mm-hmm.
Where at that time, George Foreman was, you know, just very much considered, he wasn't outspoken on any particular issues. He walked around with a German Shepherd dog, which was very much considered. It reminded the people of the German Shepherds who were sicked on the civil rights activists and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So he was so disconnected from the pain and the frustration of the people. But Ali was known around the world, even at that time, as one who embraced that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, and the spirit of the film and the odds that he overcame to beat George Foreman in George's prime, where he was just destroying people who had beaten Ali, Joe Frazier and Ken Norton and people like that who had beat Ali.
Mm-hmm.
George Foreman destroyed them in one round, two rounds, just beat him unmercifully. And Ali stopped him, beat him, right? Knocked him out, KO'd him, right? TKO, I should say. And the spirit of it all just came to life in the film When We Were Kings. So I guess I'm just sort of telling people, if you really want to get a glimpse of the spiritual and the depth of the man of Ali, his boxing skills as well as his who he was as a man, you should consider checking out the film When We Were Kings.
I remember the interview he did after he fought Leon Spinks, and Spinks won that fight in 78. And they were asking him, you know, because of course he has that "I'm the greatest," and mm-hmm. he's doing that, he's doing his thing, and he says, his quote is, "We all lose in life. You lose your wife, you lose your mother. We all have losses. And what you have to do is to keep living, overcome those losses and come back. You can't just go and die because you lose."
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, you know, you win some, you lose some, but
then he came back and beat Spence.
And then he came back, right. So he came back and ultimately beat him again. So, you know, his story is just, I don't know how you can't be motivated by his life from the age of 12 all the way up until his final transition yesterday. His life is a remarkable story. And I'm sure there will be 50,000 more books written about Muhammad Ali in this lifetime.
50,000?
50,000. There are already lots of books, but since his transition, there will be 50,000 more books written about Muhammad Ali. And each one of them will have their own angle and their own perspective about Ali. All the people that have walked with him and who's known him, you know, will tell their story about Muhammad Ali. But I can say that he was just such a great icon. And someone for me politically, I have always followed what he espoused about the issues of justice and equity and how important that is to the world. And most people, you know, they call him polarizing because he's speaking about oppressed black people or oppressed Vietnam, or he said the third world people. You know, to me, it is the duty of the civilized, right, to work to uplift those who are not in that same, don't have that same access and ability. Is that is your job, that's your duty. And that is, I think, a person who wants to walk on the earth in a particular way is not good enough to say, well, I'm a Christian and do nothing at all to uplift the condition of other people, or I'm a Muslim and do nothing to change the condition of other people, or to sit by and watch the exploitation of other people. And then say that I'm a Muslim or I'm a Christian or I'm a Buddhist. And, you know, you call these titles upon yourself, but you don't do the thing that they represent. And I think that that is the thing that Muhammad really points out, is that I'm willing to sacrifice it all. I'm willing to sacrifice it all for everyone and all of his family. And we just know that they're suffering a great loss at this point, and certainly send our condolences out to the universe with the rest of the world. We just know it's a great loss.
It is. You know, there are times when celebrities or icons who pass, and, you know, of course life goes on, but there's a deep sense of loss when Muhammad Ali, when someone like him makes that transition. So I'm very grateful that we have the ability to, there's so many things written about him. There's so much history that's still there. And we still have an opportunity for those. I think I've corrected our issue with the phone lines here. If you want to give us a call down here, 217-359-5483, 217-359-6545, either one of them, the lines are open and available to you. We like to hear from someone who was deeply impacted, especially during the time when Muhammad Ali was taking many of the stances that that he took during his the prime of his life, and especially when he was stripped of his title, opposing the Vietnam War, changing his name, whatever that action may have been that inspired you or had some impact on you. I'd love for you to give us a call down here, 217-359-5483. Or 217-359-6545. Again, you know, this survey that Sister Carol told you all about, You can look at that, up on the homepage, weft.org, and click on that link to take the 2-minute survey. It's very important that for a radio program like WEFT, the only way we really get a chance to know who's listening, what you really want us to discuss, what those topics are, and how you how much you appreciate the program, is for you to reach out to us in a way that that's easy for us to monitor and that we can track. So if you would go, all of you who are listening today, take the time to go to the weft.org homepage and do this and take the survey so that we can find out what you'd like to hear more from us and what you'd like to see us do down here as Airshifters. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can also become one yourself.
Yeah, you can.
So let's see. You know, there's a lot going on today. Like I said, those of you who may be just tuning in and maybe you want to get yourself up or get your children together and head on out they're probably gathering right now over at on Mattis Avenue at the Unemployment Center, the WOE Project, Working on Excellence is what it stands for. And they are asking folks to come out today to participate in the gun violence, the position that they're taking against gun violence in the community. They want you to come out and walk with them through Garden Hills. And then there's going to be a break around the lunch period. And then they're going to do another walk, another march over in the north end of Champaign, trying to speak to and offer their opposition to the gun violence that's taking place in our community, especially in the Black community. So we're going to be heading over there when we get out of here to go to the one in Garden Hills. And we're encouraging you, all of you, to also come out and join our young people as they try to take a stance against this violence that's taking place in the community. We've got someone calling down here at the 359-9338 number. I would really appreciate it. I guess Carol's going to take your call, but we want to hear from you live at 217-359-5483 or 217-359-6545. 217-359-5483 or 217-359-6545. I am prepared to take your call if you want to give us a call down here. So this the WOE Project is what I'm trying to talk to you all about to make sure that people are aware of it. It's a community organization, and WOE stands for Working on Excellence. It is a group of African-American youth who, of course, are getting a bad rap nowadays because most people are talking about all the negative things that are taking place and the gun violence, as we should be addressing those things. But the WOE Project is a movement. It says we are a group of friends in the community that believe we can make a difference and change lives one project at a time. We want to invite everyone to join us on our Love March. Love overcomes violence everywhere. When June 11th, starting point 1307 North Mattis, the unemployment office, they're going to meet there. As a matter of fact, they met at starting around 8:30. And they did a balloon release at 9 a.m. For anyone who has died due to any type of violence. The march will proceed immediately after that. So basically from 9 to 11:30 is the march. They're going to do a break. They're going to meet back at 12:30 at the Douglas Center at 512 East Grove Street for another march around that area. And then afterwards, there will be refreshments at the park. They have T-shirts that they're selling. And you can contact the young lady's name is Naisha. 312-752-8746, 312-752-8746, or you can reach Teddy at 217, trying to make sure I can see that, it looks like 600-0762. So reach out to them. Hopefully all of you can come out and be supportive of this, of the WOE Project. And see what we can help our young people build to help address the issues that they are facing on a daily basis. So I don't know if I'm having a problem with my my phone down here. Did you get that call, Sister Carol?
No, they hung up before I got there. But I think you know how to work the board, don't you?
Oh, you got jokes or something this morning. Do you know how to work the board? Of course, I know how to work the board.
And the lines are open?
Yes, the lines are open, Sister Carol.
Well, that means people don't want to talk about that.
Is that right? Is that what that means? Let's see what they want to talk about then. Go ahead, caller. You are on the air.
Yeah, good morning, Aaron.
Hey, Ted.
Yeah.
I thought I'd strike a nerve with you. Go ahead bro.
Some programs. First, I'd like to just mention this, that in 1996, this was the Olympics. I had an opportunity to go to the World Olympics, and I had a chance. I was in the arena to happen to see Muhammad Ali, who had the torch. They gave him the the final word with the torch to light the flame to open the game. And I was wondering if he was going to make it. We were sitting there watching him shake in such a way, but we knew that man always had that determination inside.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Is that finally, he got it on there and got that flame started, and it lit it. And, of course, there was a sigh of relief that went all over everywhere. But it was real nice. I had an opportunity to actually see them there. The other time that I had a chance to see him was just a lot of times just through film clips. And then, of course, when he made the news, because some of us who were active back in the day when we were young lions and we had the energy, we were just involved in a lot of different things. And, of course, that was the voice that kind of would speak up and just to give everybody a chance to feel like they had a lot of dignity and pride. He's not the first person who started. Of course, we had the people like Martin Delaney, Harriet Tubman, Marcus Garvey, Ida B. Wells, Barnett. They were all doing the same things, too, but it was just that their voice had a very narrow platform. But if you look at Muhammad Ali when he came out in the 1960s, I think that that's when I begin to hear more about him, particularly during the Olympics back in the 1960s, because I kind of kept up with that. And that's when he won the gold medal. And then he came back home, and the news was covering was the fact that he went into the restaurant, he couldn't get served. And then, of course, the people in there said that they weren't, serving Negroes, and that kind of upset him. So the story was is that he went then walked across that bridge somewhere there in Louisville, and he threw that gold medal in the river. And, I thought that was really something. So during that period, it was early, and I'm at a young age now. And, of course, there was a lot of things going on because his attitude, I think, was somewhat shaped based on a lot of other things that were, actually going on in the South, and such as all that was following the Supreme Court decision, the Rosa Parks story, and Emmett Till, who was from Chicago, who got killed, bus boycotts, Little Rock Nine, lunch counter sit-ins, Freedom Riders. You had all of that going, coming up at least until the 60s and 61. And then, of course, we then begin to see film clips of him talking about joining this religion, which is the religion of the Nation of Islam. And he was bringing Elijah Muhammad, really, to his bouts. And people were very, very concerned about that. And, of course, as you know, what his spirit was like, he wasn't going to denounce his faith, nor did he denounce the people who were around him. So he stayed with that. And so we just always saw him as a voice that just brought pride. He was saying he was black and he was proud long before we heard the song.
You know, Ted, one of the things that you said that really struck me, and just thinking about, and I was hoping that someone would call and bring back to memory something like this. I remember the torch lighting, and I remember him shaking, and I do remember feeling a sense of pride, and it was just some energy that he was able to transfer to other people through his accomplishment and that dedication. And I remember him shaking profusely, holding that torch, but you could see that he didn't want any help either.
No. Right?
You know, he wanted to do this on his own, and he somehow knew how to embody the magnitude of those moments. And thinking about, throwing that gold medal, it's like saying that, when you described him bringing Elijah Muhammad to the fights and taking the positions that he took, the message to me is that you do not that you actually build more of a platform and more of a dignified life by taking these particular positions, as opposed to worrying about how you're going to eat tomorrow. Because when you take positions like that, the people will help you eat tomorrow. Right. You know, and
right.
I just see this in him. And because I looked at his record, you know, he was 56-5. Right.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of boxers who have very similar records.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Why was he still, and why is he, and why is he still considered the greatest, even though he lost five times? Because he transcended
boxing.
What he
boxing.
Did in the ring.
That's right.
And based upon the principal positions that he took in life around and the values of the things that he believed in.
He was a radical for truth. He was a radical, and I would say a militant as well, because he was concerned about hunger. He was concerned about poverty. He was concerned about injustice. He was concerned about those things. He was a great humanitarian because he did go and do a whole lot of other things. Now, I'm hearing things during this his session, his funeral, of people who are saying what he was doing all over the world. I didn't know he was in all those different places. I did know that. As far as going to Iraq, he brought our soldiers home.
Mm-hmm.
I know he was able to go have a voice in some of these other countries, and particularly in Africa. I know that he was doing a lot of help there, but some of these other countries, I really didn't know that his imprint, his footprint was there.
Yeah, I didn't know about the trip to Iraq to get the other, I think it was like 15 other American hostages.
Soldiers.
Uh-huh.
Right, yeah. and brought them back to America. So he's done a whole lot of good things. The other thing I had, he stayed in his lane, mm-hmm. in terms of his culture and his people.
Yes.
And he didn't deviate from that. Because if you look around the world and you look at other people, they're doing the same thing. So, but it's almost like we're not allowed to do it.
Uh-huh.
As a people, you mm-hmm. see, as a group. So it's almost like we can't have freedom as long as we... keep being friends, would seem like, with people who we think are going to help us. And so he was the type of person, he just wasn't going to trade his individual freedom in for friendship and just try to be a part of an establishment that had already written rules about his place and where he should fit in life.
Yeah, definitely.
And he's kind of spoke for a lot of us who really understood it, because you're really just talking about getting your rights mm-hmm. in an ordinary way.
And, you know, one of the things that you spoke of, I think I'm going to get a call here in a few seconds, but I do want to speak to, you know, as a 12-year-old, going to just say, look, somebody took my bike and you know, it was basically my only mode of transportation, and I want to go whoop them, so I want to learn how to fight. That's one thing, right? That gives you some context. But where does the mindset and the, I'm trying to search for the correct words here, but basically, where does the development take place for him to get to the point for him to say, I'm gonna change my name, first of all, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
to have some of these positions that he had around race, right? Some mm-hmm. of that had to come from just being in Louisville and living in the times that he lived in. But I do believe that some of the, whether it was the teachings or the whatever the understanding he got through the nation, but then he also developed a position through why would he take this position as a conscientious objector? That doesn't just like pop up in your head, right? You know what I'm saying? So like you as a historian, you don't know history just because history exists. You know history because you have researched and because you have studied it.
You have
know?
Studied it.
So I just think that as we talk about the context and the who the man was, a lot of times people like to talk about the after effects, the finished product. They don't like to talk about how the person got to where they are.
I think most of his, and I'm sure he probably kept up with news as well as anybody during that period. Generally, we had the radio, because a lot of times when Joe Louis was boxing, you have to remember when he knocked out this German guy. Black people at that time, man, when they announced that he was a heavyweight champion of the world, Joe Louis, everybody then had to go get inside, get in their houses. Because you're going to find a few people going to get lynched in the South.
Mm-hmm.
You see, we're talking about a period of time when this is really, really rough.
Yeah.
So black people had to cow in a lot of situations because she had no control of anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had to be very careful about being proud. We all wanted to be proud. We had people telling us that that's the way we're supposed to be. Anytime you're not proud of who you are, you're really not in alignment with God.
Mm-hmm.
So we've always fought to try to be that in alignment. And I've seen a man demonstrate it so well as this Muhammad Ali. He just stood up and just says, Muhammad Ali, my name is the Most High. And he just had that spiritual part. That's really our spirituality in us.
Yes, sir.
And sometimes you try to smother it out, but it don't work. I understand when we react to certain things, we kind of, we react a lot of times without planning. And then, of course, what we're doing is we call ourselves fighting back, and we just don't have the proper tools, in order to defend ourselves.
Yeah.
So we get kind of caught up in a lot of things that really that wasn't the intention.
Right.
But it's ourselves, we just call ourselves trying to stand up and just really do what was right. And basically that's the kind of person that I think most people in that I know who grew up in my era wanted to be like, and they wanted to do right. It didn't matter what color you were or who you were, because even when we were in service, we had people coming from all different stripes.
Yeah.
So, but we were all together on the same page when it come to, number one, trying to protect ourselves and do what was right and have respect for one another. So we've always done that, and we've always felt that way. I just think it's a natural way to be, but sometimes in society they have a way of trying to sort of suppress your idea or
what you have to say.
And try to then turn it up to be something else other than what you would, you know, you're striving to try to make it better, really, for all folks.
Yeah. So, Ted,
but
I got another call.
Nobody wants you to be strong enough to stand for yourself, and basically that's something that we have to continue to do.
Yes, sir. Hey, look, I thank you so much for calling. I got another call here on the other line, so I appreciate the call, brother.
Okay, appreciate it.
All right, bye-bye. All right, go ahead, caller, you on the air.
Hey, am I on the air now?
Yes, you are.
Oh, I had a comment about Garden Hills.
Okay.
I used to be a delivery driver, and I'd have to go out there at night. And there's no streetlights.
Wow.
And I was like, man, you know, I just want to, you know, do my job and deliver food to people, man, but I don't want to get shot or something, you know. And Garden Hill's not the only neighborhood that's got problems. I mean, there's Devin's Downs in Champaign. There's over here in Urbana. It's just dangerous to be a cab driver or a delivery driver, man. It's crazy. I don't know what's going on.
Well, you know, it's one of the things that we, the young people over there and the parents over there have talked about. No sidewalks and no streetlights. Now,
yeah, no sidewalks, no streetlights. That is, you know where, Bradley Avenue, Neeler's neighborhood back in there, they ain't got no streetlights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so look, no, that's really a very important component to one of the things that when you start talking about the quality of life and the ability to just sort of enjoy your neighborhood and stuff like that. Some of the basic amenities like street lights for evening walks. You know, I've had people come in East Urbana who are lit, it's very dark over there. And something about the way some of these neighborhoods were constructed during that time that they didn't have a lot of street lights. They just didn't put them in. I don't know why. But it is something that I'm going to talk to the young people today about and to see how they could possibly move forward and get some of that done. I do believe there's some that were put up on Hedge Road, but there needs to be more for sure.
Oh, I had a girlfriend lived on Hedge Road.
Yeah, so.
And it's the Hedge Road. I think somebody told me one of the most dangerous streets in Garden Hills is Paula Drive.
Hmm. Well, I know it's a lot of them out there, so I really appreciate the call. Thanks a lot for listening.
Hey, do you know where Dobbins Downs is?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, we had a manager when I was a food delivery driver. He says, man, you don't want to go out there after dark. You don't have to.
Hmm. Well, I definitely know Dobbins Downs quite well, and it's not the neighborhood that it used to be. And it has some of the same concerns, I think, about lighting and all that kind of different stuff.
Well, I like you guys' radio.
All right. Thanks for listening, man. I appreciate the call.
Hey, when's the union hour? Come on.
11 o'clock. Labor hours at 11.
All right. Thanks very much for your time.
Bye-bye. All right, you all. So A lot going on. And the lines are open for you if you want to give us a call. 217-359-5483. 217-359-6545. We're down here live on Higher Ground, Brother A-Dub, Sister Carol. We have many different titles and stuff like that, but y'all know us, what we do, what we stand for, what we're trying to get done, and we're trying to encourage other people to also get involved. You know, there's so much happening, whether it's in the electoral politics or it's just the politics of life, that when you, whoever you are who's listening, when you don't bring your gift, your skill, your talent, your virtue to the table, then something's missing. Something that could be extremely necessary or vital to the success of our community or of a particular project. What you bring to the table is missing, whether it's your energy, another body, another mind, another set of eyes, another perspective. You may have other ways to contribute through art, through song, through dance, financially. There's so many different things that create, that make up your community that may be missing. Your skill set as a craftsman, whatever it may be, that missing component hurts the idea or hurts the project and sometimes prevents the success of the project. So the reality is that if you are not willing to make the sacrifices of a Muhammad Ali, and what I mean by that is the training as a 12-year-old to be the heavyweight champion, to get to the goal as a heavyweight champion, or to search for your that level of spirituality that gives you the guidance that allows you to take principled positions and not be bought and sold, right, by capitalists and by the billionaires who want to buy you off and starve you out. You're going to have to make your life valuable to yourself. And the way that you do that is to live by the principles that you have determined and decided that are your guiding light, and not by the, you know, chasing the dollars and only your entire focus being paying your rent or trying to find a meal. Because as we talked about earlier, all women and men who take principal positions in their life, you've seen the people rally around them and give them what they need. Many people don't. If I ask you, what was Martin Luther King's job? Most people would say that he was a pastor. So how was he pastoring and traveling all over the country? How is that possible? You know, so when you start to think about even from many people from a religious perspective talking about Jesus or whoever the prophet or the person may be that you're describing, the deity or whatever, they were fed by the people. Right. And so when the sister and I take different positions or we out here fighting, we weren't chasing jobs. Opportunities came our way based upon the principles, and then the people stood with us. The 14,000 supporters who donated to your campaign, they didn't have to donate $5,000 each, right? It allowed the more people, the lighter the work for everyone. So be a part, y'all. Don't allow yourself to be, you know, taken advantage of by these capitalists who work you until you're too tired to even go and be involved and to live your life, or that you then choose a set of things in life that are that placate you but don't allow you to actually live. They allow you to exist, but they don't allow you to live.
I think the gentleman who called in just a few minutes ago talked about Garden Hills. We had talked about Garden Hills probably for about, I would say, certainly over 10 years that Garden Hills has been, you know, in our focal point because of a few things that we know are necessary to ensure safe communities, right? And they've not had the proper representation on the city council to address the needs of Garden Hills. And the people in Garden Hills haven't taken the appropriate political response to their needs in Garden Hills. So why you would be in a community that A doesn't have sidewalks, yet they were issuing at one point an enormous number of jaywalking tickets in Garden Hills, and there were no sidewalks. And that, I don't believe, has been addressed to this day, that they still don't have sidewalks in Garden Hills. And I don't know about the jaywalking tickets. We'd have to look back at that. But that was an injustice that just was perpetrated and continued for several years when we really began to be involved in organizing. But this is over 10 years now, and they still don't have sidewalks, or they don't have lights in Garden Hills. As the caller pointed out, that is so dark in Garden Hills, you would think you in a country or rural area, but you're in the midst of the city with no lights in the area, yet you continue to have a lot of violence and fights and things that happen, certainly in that area a lot more. And every single area that has a high level of violence and crime, you could also trace that back to social, what I would say, social inequity, where you have lots of young people who don't have access to employment or jobs. You also have a lot of people in the area who are working multiple jobs, and many of them can't be at home to watch them teenagers that's running around in the streets, and because they're working, trying to pay for the living of the family. So there's so many other things that can be teased out as to why high crime areas are usually minority communities, because you have a system or structure that Muhammad Ali was speaking to of injustice that locks people out. And you can't ignore that when you're talking about public safety. So public safety doesn't equate to just buy more officers, right? Public safety must equate to employ young people. Public safety mustn't equate to infrastructure developments. And if you have representation that can't see that and don't understand that, then you, being responsible and conscious, need to awaken your neighbors and get better representation. Black people especially, I think, need to become increasingly sensitive to the natural responses and the essence of how we are living. This is an important part of transcending and growing and developing. We have to make our responses legitimate expressions, but they have to be tied to a political consciousness. And I think that's what Muhammad Ali really stood for. Yes, he was involved in boxing and his athleticism was clear, but he was also aware and tied to a political response that was appropriate for the time. And we have to begin to not only demand, but step up to the political response that's required at this time. And I don't care whether your representative is black or not. If that person doesn't give you the appropriate response in policy for your area, then you need to replace them and get somebody else that will address the needs of your area. And that is the most important thing. Not having a person of color, that doesn't matter if the person doesn't produce anything for your community. That's the most important thing. And so, and I think the political response has been lackluster in relationship to the areas in violence and dealing with issues of violence.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, of course, we know that these local elections will be coming up. You have to make sure that you are who's out there who's ready to take up that mantle and say, hey, I want to represent the people in my neighborhood and those who I'm that will vote me in so that I can fight for them.
You know what I think about? I thought about the story of Danielle Chenoweth, who when she went to the city council in Urbana, she was the youngest member of the Urbana City Council at the time. She was in her 20s, and she saw in her neighborhood, in her ward, that there was a great need for representation in that area. And being a young person didn't stop her from saying, you know what, I'm going to run for alderman and I'm going to represent my ward and I'm going to get the improvements necessary for the people that live in my ward. And so she did. She ran against the odds. She didn't have a lot of money. She ran against the odds and won that seat, and she was one of the best representatives, I think, on that city council at the time to represent our ward. And so I'm suggesting to people who are marching this morning, who, and I'm going to go tell them this myself, that instead of just marching in a particular area to bring awareness to a subject, awareness is good, but awareness is not enough. You have to actually say, okay, well, who's going to respond in the political consciousness necessary to bring about the thing that you want? And it is necessary to have activism and politics merged together in order for you to get the outcomes that you need for your community. That's what my message is to all the young people who are walking. Which one of you are prepared to represent Garden Hills, where you see the focal point is, and mm-hmm. Douglas Community, where you see that other focal point is not getting the representation it needs? Which one of you are going to step forward and get that representation on the city council so that you then can respond appropriately to the needs of those communities?
Mm-hmm. And so I think that is extremely important. You know, I know that James Tinsley is going to be joining Lorraine Coward on the county board to represent both of those particular areas, I believe.
As the county board. As the county board. District.
Right. And so those who are excited and those who hopefully can be trained to actually go in and represent the issues of the people, then they should to be willing to step up to the plate. Absolutely. And I think that's not the end all be all, though. We know that politics is one part of it.
I said merge them.
Right.
You need them both. Yeah. Activism and political.
There's an economic component that's also very important there. Right. You know, in this society that we live in, there is a need. Part of that freedom, as Muhammad Ali talked about, not only did they, when you talk about the buyouts and starve out stuff, they had suspended his passport, so he couldn't go make the $10 million or so that he could have made overseas.
Mm-hmm.
But you do have to have a, especially when you're running your own business or you're doing things like that, it does give you a little bit more flexibility and freedom to speak your mind, and you don't worry about the backlash, but also the protection that you, that comes from being organized. As we say, the coin is in the fish's mouth. Also, you're going to find that when you are outspoken and organized, it actually makes it more difficult for you to be targeted, right? Because now it's pretty easy and everybody knows that you're being attacked or ridiculed or fired because you have taken a position and then you have some recourse. But when you are sort of in a silo all alone trying to take a position, then it's difficult. Then people do become, it's easier to target you because things can happen to you without everybody else knowing what's going on. So you do want to be organized. One of the things that I'm excited about this young group of people is that they have taken the time to try to pull together something, right? And to take a position. So I want to encourage them to continue to grow, right? Because we all need the space to be for growth and development. I want us to continue to grow, for them to continue to grow in that regard as we were given the opportunity to do so. And I want to be here for them as others were there for us to try to teach us the ropes, whether it was Rev or whoever it was teaching us the science of nonviolence and the science of organizing. So we want to be there for them as well, for the young people who are looking for opportunities to become organizers, activists, to become elected officials, get involved with the unions, various different things that become part of the fight for working class people. And also to bring, to challenge them, right? That regardless of what your situation is, you do still have a level of responsibility for your actions, right? You cannot just explain away your actions as if, you know, yeah, well, somebody doesn't like me. Therefore, as Ali said, just because you lose, you can't just go somewhere and die.
Right.
And so you can't, and that means mentally, physically, spiritually, all of that. You can't just give up.
I think it's something that Muhammad Ali stood for. And he would, in all of his interviews, he would talk about Elijah Muhammad, the teaching of Elijah Muhammad. It set a structure for him. It incorporated a structure, and it also incorporated discipline in Muhammad as well as all of those around. And the discipline that you and I also incorporated and structured in ourselves so that what you say our capital is?
Mm-hmm. Integrity.
Integrity.
In our, it spins in both systems.
That's right, of our worldview. And we get to defend our collective interests through that discipline and through that integrity, right? And so we get to express ourselves of on all matters, right, of social and political importance, because we live a collective lifestyle that is based on discipline and our integrity. And that spins in all systems, right? So I can represent the interests of all the people if the interests of those people are for the worldview, the best worldview of our society. I'm not going to represent the interests of the corporations because we don't share the same worldview. And those corporations may be exploiting workers or, you know, denying them their rights. So those, that's not a worldview that I share. And so somebody else might, but it won't necessarily be me. I try to make my worldview that of the collective consciousness of the improvement of the people. And that's the important part of what Muhammad Ali stood for. And I hope, like you said, you support the young people's organizing, but it has to be through the collective view of integrity and through that discipline that you become the, I think, the political structure that you need. The discipline helps guard against the enemy who's going to attack you, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody don't agree with State Rep. Carol Ammons. They don't all agree. But the discipline that I've shown as State Rep, the work, the policies, all of those things are my protection. And so the 80% that calls my office and say to me to stand firm against the attack, the right wing attack of Rauner, is 20% that call and say, I disagree totally with her. She's absolutely crazy. Those are that's the 80-20. That's a huge difference. And so that gives me a little protection.
And look, it is necessary to have that. I'm going to play a short clip. And it sort of speaks to one of the concerns that we were raising, that I raised when I opened up today's show, around how we hear Muhammad Ali being discussed today.
Lines. Tributes have poured in from presidents, sports stars, and celebrities worldwide. Liberals and conservatives alike have lined up to sing his praises. Call me a cynic, but sorry, I can't believe that all of it is truly heartfelt and genuine. Think about it. If a top black athlete today converted to Islam and then declared that he wouldn't, quote, help murder and burn another poor nation simply to continue the domination of white slave masters because his real enemy was at home, he would be denounced as a traitor, as anti-American. If that top black athlete today called for reparations, saying the U.S. government should admit its guilt over slavery and take $25 billion from its defense budget to build houses for black Americans, he'd be dismissed as a divisive crackpot. If that top black athlete today declared his, quote, support for the Palestinian struggle to liberate their homeland and oust the Zionist invaders, he'd annoy a lot of top politicians and might even be labeled an anti-Semite. But those are the exact things that Ali did say. And remember, back when he was saying this stuff, he was reviled too. He was attacked and demonized. Millions hated Ali. Top sports writers called him a punk and the white man's burden. The NSA tapped his phone. Yet today he's lauded by the same types of people who slammed him in the 60s and 70s. Today he's praised by political and media elites for supposedly transcending race and religion. As one commentator pointed out, throughout U.S. history, white Americans have toned down the life stories of radical people of color so that they can celebrate them as they want them to be, not as they were. But the inconvenient truth for establishment types now jumping on the Ali bandwagon is that he was a radical, a revolutionary, a proud black Muslim American who railed against both domestic racism and foreign wars. And look, I'm not saying it's not a good thing that so many powerful people have either changed their views on Ali and what he stood for, or pretended not to notice what he stood for. Nor am I saying they're all hypocrites. No, all I want is a little more consistency and a little less whitewashing of history. Let me finish with a line from the poet Maya Angelou, who once said, "People will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel." Muhammad Ali made millions of us feel proud of our identity, our ethnicity, our political views, our religious beliefs, and we will never forget him. Rest in peace, my brother. Rest in peace.
I am the greatest.
All right, all right. We are back. That was Upfront. Mehdi Hassan from the, I think it's Al Jazeera, wrote this piece. And I thought it really was a great summation of what we were trying to get across, but also hoping to inspire in other people that you're just not, as Grandpa Walfield used to say to us and CU citizens, the turtle cannot move unless it sticks its neck out. So you're going to have to take some chances. You're going to have to take some risk. You're going to have to put yourself in this flow, right? If you really want change to occur, it's just not going to be easy. And if you're taking that path of least resistance, then you're probably not affecting change that you claim that you want to see happen.
Right kind of trouble.
So most definitely. So we've got about 10 minutes. You know, if there's somebody else who wants to give us a call down here, I'd love to hear from you. 217-359-5483 or 217-359-6545.
While they get ready to call you for this last one, I'll put my last little sense on it. Muhammad Ali shook up the world.
He shook up the world by
knocking out Sonny Liston, right?
I'm the greatest.
But Muhammad Ali really shook up the world by demonstrating to the so-called world powers outside of the boxing ring that as a young man with a worldwide following, he understood his responsibility as a black man and as a global role model. He demonstrated that he was not afraid to sacrifice money and celebrity in order to stand for principle, his ethnic integrity, and as a respect of humanity and other things sacred. As we celebrate the life and work of Muhammad Ali, let us think past the thriller in Manila and the rumble in the jungle. Let us instead remember Muhammad Ali's greatest fights outside the boxing ring. Let us remember and celebrate what he gave up to fight those fights because he valued his integrity and his desire not to see himself, his people, and others compromised by the forces of white supremacy and the attempt to reinforce the effects of his domestic and international agenda. Let us also think about the responsibility that we must carry as we continue on our journey to preserve our personal and collective integrity and to secure political, economic, and social justice for ourselves and our fellow human beings. Long live the champ.
Yes, indeed. Amazing inspiration to so many human beings. And I'm sure there'll be more conversations. One of the things that I think Ali never shied away from, and we shouldn't either, is what were the things that he learned throughout this process? You know, did he believe in 2016 what he believed in 1961? Right. You know, what is the growth and development of the man? So I don't think that we should just as we want to highlight the strong positions and principal positions he took, because they are inspirational to people. I think it's also important that we see where one may have said they learned from a position or mistake that they made, so we don't duplicate that mistake, right? And so I'm just saying that there should be some deeper conversations into the life of the late great Muhammad Ali. So we've got a couple of minutes and we got things going on. Again, I want to remind people, get out and support the WOW Project. They are out right now marching in Garden Hills, raising awareness or speaking out against the gun violence that's taking place in the community and trying to see what they can do through the form of projects, of different projects that they have thought of that could bring about a difference in their community. I celebrate them for that. I encourage them for that. I want to get out and try to at least to participate in that with them for a little while before we have to get out of here. So that's over in the Garden Hills area right now. These young people have organized other young people and other people in the community to get out and support this effort of the WOW Project. And they'll also be over in the North End area around 1 o'clock. And they're going to have a get together at Douglas Park from 3 until.
And I think
what you got going on, State Representative Carol Lammons, what's coming up for folks
in the, in a
very
the last
successful white party, white attire party.
Yes, right. White attire. We did have a wonderful celebration of my birthday on June. My birthday is actually June 1st. We had a celebration on June 4th at the Flight Bar. Big shouts to Josh, the owner of the Flight Bar, who just does a spectacular job there in Lincoln Square. To my magnificent staff, Michelle Jett, who's supposed to be on vacation, but we talk every day anyway, and to Miss Jill Clemens, who helps put together our events. They just did a magnificent job putting that together. We'll be in session continuously through the summer trying to work on this budget. The budget compromise, there's some progress being made, but I can tell people, I spoke to one of our chairs while I was in Chicago yesterday, Friday, about the, working groups and how that was going. And, he said, right when we, you know, this, I could see the image of, Chris Rock did that skit where he said, where we take 10 steps forward and then somebody do something, you take you 5 steps back.
Right.
There's a little bit of tango going on between, working groups and the governor's office who, you know, we may be making progress on workers' comp somewhere and then they'll throw another, impossible thing to reach onto the table and that takes you 2 or 3 steps back. And so, we don't have a solution at this point, but it is certainly, headlong in the way of trying to get to a solution as soon as possible. We know what's going on in the community. I know personally what's happening to community agencies, which is sickening. Hopefully we can get something solved on this matter soon.
Well, I know that it's going to be a long battle. There's much changes.
So let me just say to people what Muhammad Ali just taught us this morning is either they try to starve you out or buy you out. And that's such an important part of what's going on in the state of Illinois. You bring in a billionaire who says, we will starve you out or we will buy you out. And that's what he attempted to do with legislators, to purchase legislators to vote in his way. And that is what he's doing with higher education and human services. He figures the whole Superman thing will starve you out and twist their arm and make them tap out. So I just wanted to say that.
Black Superman music piece, but that one's a little too long. On the way out, I want to say, look, as John Lee Johnson would always say, stay out of trouble. And as Paul Muth says, get in the right kind of trouble. I got a little Muhammad Ali, Stand By Me on the way out.
Is it playing? You think you got Muhammad Ali, Stand By Me?
I should have.
What, did you turn off the mics?
Okay, great stuff.
And hopefully I'll have a little music on board today. I'll have some time for that. I've got some Rebecca Gordon with Law and Disorder Radio. Thanks to everybody that helped out and letting me get away for my mother's 90th birthday. I was out of town 4 or 5 days, and I'm still a little dislocated from it. But it was big fun. And a long life to you, too. So, Rebecca